to the heart of innovation. 60 minutes that can save life and limb with new breakthrough ideas and innovation changing the healthcare landscape. Brought to you by patient advocacy group, thewaytomyheart.org, in partnership with Abbott. Here are your hosts for the Heart of Innovation, Emmy Award-winning journalist and founder of The Way to My Heart, Kim McNicholas, and interventional cardiologist and founder of the Save My Piggies Health Education Series, Dr. John Phillips.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the show. We have a really big topic today. It is probably the number one question we get asked from patients around the world. It's how do we reverse type 2 diabetes? It is a true epidemic and continuing to get worse, not only in the United States, but around the world. And we've got to do something about it. The American Diabetes Association reports that every one in two U.S. adults have either pre-diabetes or diabetes. And that is truly concerning because the complications from diabetes are actually really awful, including peripheral artery disease. You have blindness. I mean, so much can happen with too much sugar in your blood. So we have Dr. Michael Danziger, who is going to be joining us. He wrote the amazing Tufts University Diabetes Reversal Program. He has a brand new program in Massachusetts that we're going to talk about, maybe even talk to a patient who is in that program and her struggles as well as her successes through the program and with diabetes overall and its complications. So we have a really good show ahead. Lots of people writing in and even jumping on the call already with questions for Dr. Danziger. So Dr. John Phillips, I think it's full speed ahead.
Dr. John Phillips, spectacular, vascular moment of inspiration.
Yes, Dr. Phillips always has those moments of inspiration, but I have a feeling that we lost him. So I am going to turn to Dr. Danziger for maybe your favorite, most inspirational quote that guides you through your life and your career. You know, inspire us.
Kim, it's great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to a great conversation today. And so I'm going to quote, my favorite quote today is, stop your yapping and make it happen.
I love it. I love it. We're all about what is tangible, what can we do, and how do we just get her done? As Yoda says, there's no try, it's just do. And I know I botched it, but
yeah, we have a lot to say today, and we're going to do a lot of talking and sharing ideas, and I'm excited to answer questions. But in the end, you can talk and talk and talk and talk, but nothing happens with our health until we actually make changes and do the hard work.
And so why is diabetes so difficult? Why is diabetes so difficult? It's so difficult to do. It's difficult for people to even wrap their heads around the dietary changes they have to make. I mean, where did this all come from? Why do we have such an epidemic? I hear some that tell me it's because of this low-fat craze, and there was a replacement with sugar. Calories are better than fats. Then I've heard, I'm reading this book called The Salt Fix, and how this focus on or over-focus on reducing salt has led to the addition of sugars being put into people's diets. What is your assessment of the current diabetes craze? Why is this happening?
Kim, it's a great point. Many of us either have diabetes or pre-diabetes, or our lives have been touched by family members who have that. Most of us know people who have diabetes. It's all around us. It's a huge epidemic in the United States and throughout the world, and it seems to be getting worse and worse. So the underlying cause of diabetes is both simple and complex. I'm going to point my finger at the processed food that fills our grocery stores and our restaurants and our, you know, takeout places. And the American diet has changed so much over the past 50 years And if you just compare what you might see on grocery store shelves today versus what you can imagine it was like 50 or 100 years ago, that's my number one. That's the number one culprit, is the changes in the types of food that people are eating. And it's just reached a point that the food is so distorted from what we're designed to actually eat, that that's the main cause of obesity and heart disease and type 2 diabetes. It's the food. But it's not just the food, but that's the number one culprit right there.
And I'm going to open up a can of worms here, because I was just, I also in my side hustle, I'm still a journalist, and I'm working with companies out of Tokyo to learn more about them. They want to infiltrate the U.S. market. And one of the companies that I'm talking to and learning more about and helping to write their profile is one in which they're focusing on gene sequencing and, like, you know, our overall microbiome, the microbes, evolving those, extracting the enzymes, the proteins, and using them to create a new generation of food as one of their things. I am wondering what your thought is, you know, on our current health, where we're at with all of this processed foods that we're eating now, and where you think this is going. Are we going to have even more chronic illness with food being supposedly manufactured versus really going back to nature and how we were designed as hunters and gatherers?
That's a great question, Kim. So the key to preventing and reversing diabetes, I think, starts with the food. And the technology is not going to save us here. So fruits and vegetables and healthy proteins and one ingredient foods are always going to be the way to go. And we can continue to make advances in technology, and we can make different types of apples and, you know, find ways to have delicious strawberries all year round. And we can, you know, get better and better at providing healthy food. And that's the role for technologies, making it easier to eat one ingredient foods and getting better and better at making recipes that have clean ingredients. So all of these manufactured foods that are highly complicated and have supposed health benefits, I'm not going to bet
in a lab
any kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm always, you know, when people come to me and ask me and say, hey, you know, I have this, and I'm going to say these manufactured burgers in a lab, you know, anything grown in a lab, that is always a question. Always the safe bet is going back to natural. And coming up right here on the Heart of Innovation, we're going to have more with Dr. Michael Danziger and learn more about how to reverse diabetes 2 coming up. So stay with us.
Leg health can indicate risk for heart attack, stroke, and amputation. If you have leg pain or cramps while walking, get checked for peripheral artery disease, or PAD. PAD is plaque buildup in mainly the leg arteries. Be sure to ask your physician for an ankle brachial index, also called an ABI test, where they use blood pressure cuffs to analyze the blood pressure in your legs. If they discover you have arterial plaque that's limiting blood flow to your feet, medicine and a regimented walking program are frontline treatment. If PAD is in its advanced stages, your physician may schedule a surgical intervention. Minimally invasive tools are available to remove plaque and restore blood flow, including Cardiovascular Systems Diamondback 360 atherectomy system, which sands away plaque that is a hard calcium. It's important to discuss all options with your physician, and if told you have no options, get a second opinion. Take a stand against amputation. For more information, go to standagainstamputation.com. That's standagainstamputation.com.
Welcome back to the Heart of Innovation. For more on today's topic, go to theheartofinnovation.org. That's theheartofinnovation.org. Once again, here's Emmy Award-winning journalist Kim McNicholas and interventional cardiologist Dr. John Phillips.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I apologize for being a little bit late. I was having some technical difficulties. My computer is so bloody old that I feel like I'm using a dial-up modem here. So I'm back and better than ever. And I'm happy to be joining the crew. So real quick, if you can just indulge me for a second here. I had an inspirational quote because I know Michael had one, but I like this one. This is from E.E. Cummings. It takes courage to grow up and become who you really are. And I think we're always trying to define ourselves and kind of evolve. And part of our evolution is eating properly. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the other thing is I love history. And so I was looking into who actually helped us figure out the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which Dr. Danziger is probably going to get into. But basically, it's the difference between being kind of insulin sensitive and then insulin insensitive. But it was a physician by the name of Harold Hemsworth in 1936 out of the UK. So back in, you know, so we're going on 90 plus years of knowing about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. But yet in the US, if you look at the CDC database, approximately 98 million American adults. So that's almost more, that's about one in three are pre-diabetic. And the problem with it, and Michael, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this because, you know, we're going to talk about potentially stopping this or trying to stop it. But 80% of those people don't even know they have it. And that's crazy to me. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Pre-diabetes is an emergency. It's an emergency in this country and it's an emergency in many places around the world. And imagine your house is on fire, but the fire is small and it's just, you know, on the burner and you can recognize it and you can put it out and you can put that fire out before it's too late. But if you don't know what's happening, or if you know it's happening and you ignore it, the whole house is going to catch on fire. So that's an analogy to say that if there's a little fire on your stove, that's a potential emergency. We don't ignore that stuff. But here we are in America, and our stove is on fire, and we're ignoring it.
And that's a big question, because I know even with my dad, when he was diagnosed with prediabetes, they did send him home with the finger sticks and had him track it for a few weeks. But then they said, okay, well, you're fine. It's consistently prediabetes. No problem. And they just brushed him off and sent him out the door. And I do see this a lot with a lot of our patients that we work with, that I say, are you diabetic? They said no. And I said, are you pre-diabetic? Oh, yeah, well, my doctor says I'm pre-diabetic, but it's not a problem. That's a problem, don't you think?
It's like a fireman saying your stove's on fire, but it's not a problem until the whole house is on fire.
Exactly.
You know, the interesting thing, because I hear that as well. In fact, I was doing a procedure on a patient who was asking him if he was diabetic. He said, well, I'm pre-diabetic. And I don't know if people really know what that means, because for me, well, if we're going to use the fire analogy, I would say that's, you know, the smoke alarm going off and you're trying to air out the house a little bit. And so I'm doing things to open up the vents and open up the windows and to get the smoke alarm to turn off. But I don't know that that people are doing that, because for me, and Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way you curb this is to exercise and eat right. And yet a lot of people don't do that.
Exactly. So type 2 diabetes always starts as pre-diabetes, which then worsens. And pre-diabetes is happening when the body is not using insulin, the hormone insulin, properly. The body's not making enough insulin and it's not using it properly. And that comes after many, many years of warning signs. Most people who develop prediabetes have plenty of weight to lose. And if they can lose that weight by making lifestyle changes, it can reverse the prediabetes before it escalates to type 2 diabetes.
Because, you know, Michael, the other issue, too, is when it gets to type 2 diabetes, then you're going to start taking some medications, and we're probably going to touch on some of the medications that are out there now, some of the newer ones that, you know, have been implicated not only to help with diabetes, but weight loss, and then have some cardiovascular benefits, the GLP-1s, agonists, the Ozempics and the Wegovys of the world. But, you know, these folks ultimately then get on, you know, when you fail the meds, then you become, you put on insulin. And if I remember correctly from my internal medicine days, it's really hard to get off insulin. Like once you're on it, you're kind of on it for the duration, which then starts that cascade of other, you know, ailments, mainly cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, exactly right. It's never too late to start turning around your diabetes, no matter how advanced it is. But of course, you want to try to reverse it as soon as, you know, the earlier the better. And so there is a point that it continues to worsen and worsen over the course of many years. And it's much harder to improve it when it's been around for a decade or more.
So tell us a little bit about your strategy for, I guess, tackling this epidemic, because if truly a third of all Americans have prediabetes, this is not getting any better anytime soon. And if they're going to morph into a true type 2 diabetic, you know, we're looking at not only the cost to the patient itself, both lifestyle, you know, and just health quality years, but financially to the patient, but also, you know, the country as a whole.
Absolutely. So I used to be a primary care internal medicine doctor, but 20 years ago, I decided I'd like to just focus entirely on disease prevention and reversal. And I stopped prescribing drugs, and I believe in drugs, but I believe that people want to be on the least amount of medication possible. And if people can avoid medication by using lifestyle to treat diabetes, obesity, heart disease, et cetera, that's the number one treatment. But not enough doctors and healthcare providers are helping people do that. And so that's what I focused on for the past 20 years. And I have found over the years that in order for the healthcare providers to provide the support that patients need, you have to see the patient much more often than every 6 months or a year or even every 3 months. It's just not enough. People need much more support than they're getting, in my opinion. And so I have been seeing patients every week at first until we have a good strategy that's producing weight loss. And as the scale moves in their favor, the blood sugar moves in their favor, and the hemoglobin A1C, which measures the average blood sugar, is improving, and we just keep the momentum going. And so we need a good eating strategy, and I need to see what people are eating. I ask people to log their food and show me pictures of what they're eating. And by providing this level of intense coaching, that is how I have found that as a doctor, I can truly help people to lose weight and improve their health and reverse their diabetes and prediabetes.
But it's really that consistency, right? It's that love and attention and accountability that is consistent.
Absolutely. Most doctors are just not in a position to provide, you know, weekly, you know, level of support or even monthly. But there are a lot of dietitians out there who would love to do that sort of thing. There are a lot of personal trainers. There are a lot of ways that a person can create accountability and weekly support. And it's a shame that more doctors aren't in a position to do that. But however you get that support, putting yourself in the position of accountability, structure, and encouragement goes a very long way.
So many different healthcare systems don't have the ability. They don't have the resources. They have, for example, here with my dad and his dietitian, he was offered one appointment and then he couldn't go back to see that dietitian because she's so tapped with so many patients for 3 months. And so she fills out a template, right? Checks those boxes of the things that he needs to make changes on. And then come back in 3 months and we'll see how you're doing. And that is not effective. How do we scale what you are doing so it becomes consistent and also democratize access for those patients that don't have anything else but, let's say, Medicare or Medicaid as their insurance?
We'll find out the answer more here on the Heart of Innovation with Dr. Kim McNichols and Dr. John Phillips. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
years ago, my symptoms started with leg pain and leg cramps while walking.
Me too, with a tightness in my calves.
Well, do you know, my doctor thought that my leg cramps were a side effect of the statin he prescribed me.
Well, my doctor just brushed them off as another symptom of old age.
Mine thought the pain was radiating from my spine.
My doctor blamed my neuropathy on diabetes until I got a wound on my foot that just wouldn't heal.
Yeah, it turns out we all have peripheral artery disease, also known as PAD.
It's plaque buildup mainly in the leg arteries causing poor circulation.
For me, the diagnosis came too late and I lost my leg, but that does not have to happen to you.
No, it does not, because there are treatment options available if you're diagnosed early enough.
PAD, peripheral artery disease. If you've been experiencing leg pain, leg cramps, or neuropathy when walking, and your doctor isn't hearing you, we are. We are the Way to My Heart, the largest support network for peripheral artery disease patients, and we want to help you get back on your feet again. Visit our website at thewaytomyheart.org or call our Leg Saver hotline, 415-320-7138. Your life and limb could depend on it.
Welcome back to the Heart of Innovation. For more on today's topic, go to theheartofinnovation.org. That's theheartofinnovation.org. Once again, here's Emmy Award-winning journalist Kim McNicholas and interventional cardiologist Dr. John Phillips.
Welcome back, everybody. Happy Saturday. So, Michael, you know, before we went to break and during the break, you were describing your kind of model with respect to taking care of patients and focusing on coaching them, supporting them, less meds versus, you know, more meds, seeing them on a really frequent cadence of once a week. And so in my mind, I thought, awesome, you know, I'd love to be able to do that. But yesterday I was saying I saw 14 patients in about a 4-hour period, which is reasonably busy. But I don't have time to see folks and spend a lot of time with them, nor can I see them on a weekly basis. And I feel like what we do, and I'm as guilty as the next person, it's kind of past the buck a little bit. And I put my interventional blinders on a lot of times, and I deal with the heart and the legs. And then, well,
whoops, you're breaking up just a little bit. So I think what he's trying to say is
Let me explain how I do it. So if I told a doctor that I see the same patient every week for 3 months and then every other week thereafter, they would say, that's crazy. How can you do that? But I do it and I bill it to the insurance, and I've never had the insurance say, you can't do that. And in fact, the standard of care for intensive lifestyle coaching for type 2 diabetes is to see the patients at least 16 times in the first 6 months and then have frequent visits thereafter. And so the standard of care by the American Diabetes Association embraces very frequent visits as the number one primary treatment for type 2 diabetes. So what I'm doing by seeing patients every week or two is in line with the state of the art. Now, imagine as a doctor setting aside a half day a week, 4 hours a week, just to see patients frequently. And so you can pick a patient and say, let's find a time on Tuesday afternoons that we can meet by video, telehealth, for 20 minutes each week. And we're going to talk about what's working and what's not working. And week by week, we're just going to get better at our system. And I'm going to see the patient for the 20 minutes. And I'm going to bill it to the insurance as a visit for diabetes or heart disease or peripheral artery disease. And the insurance is going to pay me. And I bill according to the amount of time spent. So the more time I spend with the patient, the more I'm paid, and it all works out to the same amount of dollars per hour, and I can make a living, as good a living as I made in primary care. And any doctor who's in primary care has the freedom to do what I'm doing. They just don't know that they could do it. And maybe they're too busy, but there's lots of nurse practitioners and physician assistants who would be ideal for this kind of work. And in fact, in the next year ahead, I plan to train up about a dozen or so nurse practitioners and physician assistants in my method so that they can learn how to do this kind of this model, which I've been doing for 15 years.
But you're not a dietitian. So do you need to have a dietitian or certified nutritionist in order to have the specific recommendations that are well recognized? How do you go about making up this program and making the recommendations for patients on their diet?
Well, that's a good point, Kim. So I did complete a 3-year nutrition fellowship at Tufts Medical School. However, most primary care doctors have a good enough and nurse, you know, nurse practitioners and physician assistants have enough knowledge to start, right? All you need is a responsible eating plan, and you and the patient agree on a plan, and the patient's going to check their weight every week and log their food. And as long as you're providing encouragement and sensible basic nutritional advice, that's enough to start. Now, with many years of experience, I'm well versed in, you know, a wide range of different eating strategies, and I know what to say to different patients to keep them motivated. And every person is different, and you have to be a dietitian and a psychologist, and but you don't need to be. You don't need 20 years of experience in nutrition to do
right.
it. So
when it comes to that secret sauce, though, how much of the success in your program has to do with the setup of your program and the nutritional offerings, right? The education you provide versus the customization of that information with the psychology aspect that you and the different diet strategies based on what you discover about this particular human. And on top of that, the love and attention and time. Which one do you think, you know, tips it over to create success?
That's a great question. I would say it's 90% the structure and 10% the customization. So, you know, what I'm saying here is the formula for coaching is number one, frequent visits. Number, you know, especially by video. Number right. two, having a responsible eating strategy. And number three, the food logging. And almost no healthcare provider is doing that. But when you provide those three things simultaneously, that's 90% of what you need to do. The rest is just the rest is just being nice and encouraging and you know, giving sensible advice.
I want to bring in one of the patients.
Yep, I know real quick, but I wanted to, because I think this dovetails into it, Michael. What is there a selection bias with the type of patient that you get? Meaning, are they more motivated than others to actually get this done?
Oh, yes. What I'm asking for, right? Meet with me for 20 minutes by video once a week and, you know, follow an eating plan and log your food. Most people aren't up for that level of work, but doesn't that sound better than taking insulin shots or pills? If it can prevent and reverse your diabetes, I would say that even though I'm asking a lot, it's the lesser of the evils compared to what's in store for you if you don't.
And what is the retention rate for your program with these patients?
That's a great question. And honestly, so there is a lot of selection bias, right? Many people consider whether they want to do this before they decide to dive in. And once they dive in, neither they nor I know with any certainty whether they're going to rise to the occasion. But I would say 50% of my patients who 50% of patients who meet with me once stick with me for at least 3 months. In other words, I do lose half the people within the first 3 months. However, if they stick with me for at least 3 months, these people, on average, reduce their hemoglobin A1C by 1.5 percentage points, and they lose on average 10% of their body weight. And so I never know at that first visit whether this person is going to go all the way. And I know on average about half of them will. And those half get great results.
Coming up right here on the Heart of Innovation. It's great. We've learned about the model for Dr. Danziger's program. Now we're going to meet one of his patients and find out her successes and struggles. So stay with us right here on the Heart of Innovation.
Welcome back to the Heart of Innovation. For more on today's topic, go to theheartofinnovation.org. That's theheartofinnovation.org. Once again, here's Emmy Award-winning journalist Kim McNicholas and interventional cardiologist Dr. John Phillips.
Hi, everyone. We are in our Save My Piggies portion of our program, and we are talking to Dr. Michael Danziger, who has an impactful diabetes type 2 reversal program in Massachusetts. It's also available in Florida for Medicare patients. I think for more patients in Massachusetts at this point on different insurance, but at least in Florida, just Medicare. But it is an offering. We do have Cricket, who is on the line. She is one of Dr. Michael Danziger's patients, and she had come to the Global PAD Association, which is my nonprofit that helps people that have a complication of diabetes, which is called peripheral artery disease, that plaque buildup that, you know, clogs up those arteries and mainly the legs. And diabetes is a factor because even one sugar molecule can scratch those arteries, leading to that plaque buildup. So Cricket is here. Cricket was struggling, right, Cricket, for a while with your peripheral artery disease. That was accelerating. And one of the driving factors was your type 2 diabetes, correct?
Yes, Kim, exactly. Hi, everybody. I was diagnosed mid-2017. I've had multiple procedures because of it, a few bypasses in my leg, an abdominal aortic descent bypass. I've been in and out of the hospital quite a few times. I've been working with Dr. Danziger for a few months now.
Really? And so what was the catalyst? I mean, I think before we get to the catalyst of going with Dr. Michael Danziger, you knew you had type 2 diabetes, and I'm curious, what was the treatment for you? How did your doctors talk to you about it, and what was offered to you that didn't seem to quite work for you?
I was put on a few different medications, tried a few different ones. Some worked, some didn't work. Mostly with myself being accountable. I just wasn't accountable for anything. I knew what I was supposed to eat, what I'm not supposed to eat, and I still chose to eat poorly.
I appreciate your honesty. And so what was the catalyst to finally say, you know what, I'm ready for some accountability, and I'm ready for Dr. Michael Danziger's program?
Well, I've always wanted the accountability, but having, like, being in Dr. Danziger's program, he also helps hold me accountable. Like you said, his program, I speak to him every week. We meet for 20 minutes every Wednesday through video chat, and he helps keep me accountable. He helps motivate me, and he doesn't get discouraged when I tell him, listen, I've had a crap week. I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. He says, that's okay. You know, everybody's human, and just go forward from here.
Well, Dr. Danziger, that is a good question. Everyone has, and I hear it all the time, you know what, I just had a bad week. That's my excuse for falling off the wagon. And your approach to saying, okay, is what it is, you're human, let's just keep moving forward. That's a really good start that you are here. Let's try this again. And that seems to be a really successful approach, at least with Cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. So you, as a coach, you need the right balance. You need to provide encouragement and accountability, and you can't push too hard, but you can't be too much of a pushover either. And every person responds differently. And so what I'll often say is, when I hear that someone just didn't make any forward progress on a particular week is I'll acknowledge, you know, some weeks are for progress and other weeks are for maintenance. And, you know, does a good teacher kick out the students who aren't getting an A? No, they help the C students become a B student and a B student become an A student and even the F student become a D student. And so it's through encouragement and staying positive and by having good concrete advice when needed that almost anyone can improve.
Cricket, can you provide an example of one of your visits that Dr. Danziger provided to you that kind of really stuck with you and ultimately you said, okay, I'm going to create an action plan. I'm going to get this done.
I want to say it was probably, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe our third visit. I think after our second visit, I had called it quits. I was just getting frustrated with myself. I wasn't working the program the way I was supposed to be. I had one more visit with him. I think it was set up by Kim. Kim said, listen, give it one more chance. So I did the last visit with that one last visit with Dr. Danziger and said, okay, listen, I'm going to give this one more try. I wanted it to work. How badly I wanted it to work depended on me. And I dug my feet in and I stuck to the program, not going to say 100%, you know, but maybe about 90%, and I started seeing results, not so much with the weight loss, but with my numbers every day, my A1C eventually. Yeah, so it does work if you want to stick with it, and that's, you know, I had to make the decision that I'm going to do this.
You bring up a really good point about that fear of failure that leads to non-compliance, right? Fear of disappointing the doctor, knowing what you're supposed to be doing, not doing it, and then fearing going to that appointment and owning up to it. That took a lot of courage, Cricket.
Oh, absolutely. And I told my husband the other day, because we had our phone appointment on Wednesday. I was actually in the car when we had the video chat. And my husband was in the car with me. And after the video chat, my husband said, oh, you were really honest with him. I'm like, well, I can lie to him and tell him, yeah, I'm doing great. What good is that going to do me? I have to own up to my faults and be honest with myself. If I can't be honest with myself, you know, the program's not going to do me any good.
I think that's really interesting. Sorry to interrupt, Kim, because it takes a while for the patient to trust the physician and the latter, you know, the physician to trust the patient. And I was just thinking about how many times I tell a patient, I've got one guy I've been seeing for years, and every year I say, are you going to quit smoking? Are you going to quit smoking? And he's like, yeah, he never does. But I don't see him frequently enough. And I was wondering, you know, if I really got after this guy on a weekly basis, would he quit? Maybe. Probably more likely to.
Yeah, Dr. Danziger, what do you think? I mean, that you have been saying is really the key. It's that consistency.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I also said at the very beginning, right, there's a lot of talk, but if we're not seeing actual results, if we're not seeing improvement in the blood sugar and the hemoglobin A1C, then all the conversations are one thing, but I want to see real results. And Cricket, would you be willing to share the improvement in your hemoglobin A1C? If you don't want to say, you don't have to, but I just would love it if you recall the extent of the results of your effort, even though it wasn't perfect and some weeks there was no progress, the end result in your hemoglobin A1C tells a very important story, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. I want to say my most recent A1C had been done back in October. That was an 11.1. I started working with you in January, December, right? Or January. My next appointment with my some blood work. I had my A1C done was the early part of March, and it came back at a 6.4.
Oh, that is drastic. Is that typical? I mean, that's,
is that
that's
on any medication?
That's better than average. So I said, so Cricket's A1C went from like 11 to 6.5, and wow, in 6 months, and you know, she cut way back on starch and sugar and unhealthy foods, and some weight was coming off. And I think your insulin was reduced, was less.
Yeah.
Then when we start, and that is a much better result than I typically see. I usually, on average, for people who stick with me 3 months, they get 1.5 units, which is, you know, from 7.5 down to from 8 down to 6.5, let's say 1.5 units. That's pretty good.
So that translates to what, about 45 sugar point, you know, the absolute value or so, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, pretty good.
When people work with me, I can practically guarantee that their A1C is going to go down, but I don't know how much. And I know they're going to lose weight, but I don't know how much. And I know that
Doctor, I hate to cut in, but we have to go to commercial break here on the Heart of Innovation on KTRB 860 AM, The Answer.
Welcome back to the Heart of Innovation. For more on today's topic, go to theheartofinnovation.org. That's theheartofinnovation.org. Once again, here's Emmy Award-winning journalist Kim McNicholas and interventional cardiologist Dr. John Phillips.
Welcome back, everybody. So we only have about 5 minutes left. So I think this has been a fantastic show because we've not only learned
We are having trouble hearing you, Dr. Phillips.
That can help people who are diabetic and pre-diabetic and who lower their A1C. Can you hear me now? Sorry.
We can hear you now, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. So real quick, Michael, some final thoughts with us regarding your program and what are some of the next steps, and then we'll hear from Cricket to wrap up the show.
So final thoughts is we live in our house is on fire. In the United States, our house is on fire. Some of us, it's just the stove. Some of us are just at risk for the stove starting on fire. But this country has way too many houses on fire. And what I think the healthcare system in the United States is broken, and this is a symptom. And so we need, you know, here I discuss an innovative model, right? Cricket's getting weekly visits with me. I bill the insurance. She pays nothing. I make a good living. Everyone wins when we open our minds to the way that when we follow the advice of the American Diabetes Association to provide intensive one-on-one lifestyle coaching to the patients, all we need to do is follow through with the guidance. And it's the healthcare providers and the healthcare system that has the opportunity and the responsibility to overcome the barriers and make it happen. Those are my thoughts.
And for Cricket, your quick, you know, thoughts. Your A1C went down. You've lost some weight. How is that translated into how you feel with all of your vascular issues and being able to get more energy and to move more?
Like I told Dr. Zanzinger, I was tired all the time. Like, I couldn't get out of my own way. I just wanted to sleep. Now I have so much more energy. I'm not tired all the time. I'm out doing more. Not only did my A1C go down, I stopped taking insulin. I was on 40 units a day, and I have stopped having to take insulin. I still take Invokana and Glipizide, but no more insulin. Yeah, I just, and my vascular issues, they're still there. A lot of mine are hereditary, so they'll never go away, but they're not as bad as they were.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Awesome. Congratulations on all of your success. We got to hit the road. Appreciate your time, Cricket, for sharing your story and your courage and your honesty. And Dr. Michael Danziger, thank you so much for your time. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.
Listening to The Heart of Innovation with Emmy Award-winning journalist Kim McNicholas and interventional cardiologist Dr. John Phillips. Our mission is to help patients live a better quality of life through comprehensive education, real-time support, and high-touch advocacy in partnership with thewaytomyheart.org and Abbott. Our purpose is to reduce the 1.5 million heart attacks and strokes and nearly 200,000 amputations annually. For more information regarding topics you've heard discussed on today's program, go to theheartofinnovation.org. That's theheartofinnovation.org. The Heart of Innovation is for educational and informational purposes only, and advice and views shared are not a substitute for medical advice from your own supervising physician. Do not act on any information provided in this show without the explicit consent from your own healthcare team. If you think you are having a medical emergency, call your local emergency number or go to the nearest hospital or emergency room.